that true? Listen up. I know firsthand how limited a vessel medical insurance can be. This is why you need reliable medical coverage. Moore Dixon offers comprehensive global insurance tailored for yachts, covering everything from emergencies to routine checkups with flexible options and a single point of contact. Moore Dixon has been voted best health and medical insurance by captains and crew, including myself. Don't wait until the unexpected happens. Get covered today. Visit mdbl.im or email them at inquiries@mdbl.im for a free quote. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're highlighting a crucial aspect of seafaring maritime unions. Joining us is Lara Molyneux, strategic organizer at the Nautilus International Union, here to break down why union representation isn't just important, but truly essential. So welcome, Lara, to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me today. Looking forward to it.
Yes, me too. So like I was mentioning earlier, a lot of people, well, some people know about the union. In my research, it came out that the majority of people do not know what Nautilus is, what it does, and that there was even a union that actually represented yacht crew. Today we're going to uncover all that and learn a little bit more. So let's start with the basics. What is a maritime union and how does it function to support yacht crew, specifically, obviously, in this case, Nautilus?
Yeah. Okay. So Nautilus International is a maritime trade union. So we represent all the interests of seafarers. It would advocate for fair wages, safe working conditions, improved working conditions, advice and representation on employment related matters, and it can provide legal representation too on employment related matters. The aim of Nautilus is to ensure that employees are treated fairly. So it's about making sure that their employment rights are upheld. Generally in yachting, for example, salaries are generally good in comparison to other maritime sectors, but the majority of work that we do in this sector is relation to making sure that crew are paid what they're owed contractually and that they're treated fairly on board. We deal with a lot of employment related disputes, including unpaid wage claims, grievances, disciplines, hours of rest problems. Especially in Europe, we have a lot of queries in relation to traveling across borders, how long they can stay in the Schengen zone. So we'll aim to provide advice and support and representation on all these issues, be that on a commercial vessel, a private yacht, or whatever your nationality is, or whatever flag of registration the vessel is. The union was founded originally back in the 1800s by captains and seafarers. But in the yacht sector, we've actually only been doing this about 14 years.
14 years?
Yes, 14 years. But it's labor intensive.
I have been in the industry since 2006, so over, I don't even know now. You do the math. I'm not good. But almost 20 years. Yeah. And I didn't know about Nautilus until maybe like 5 years ago.
Yeah. So it was 14 years. So it was a slow process setting it up. I mean, obviously, we deal a lot with all the other sectors like cruise, gas, oil, dredges, ferries, even shore-based personnel. But yachts was slow off the ground. It was, for us, it was a new and emerging sector. It didn't look originally like they needed union representation. Mm-hmm. But we have come to realize that they absolutely do. And in fact, month on month, more members joined from the yacht sector than any other sector. So it's actually quite a big proportion now of our union. It has its own dedicated team. We have the Sea Service Department as well as the Yacht Department. So like the PYA, the Nautilus verify sea time on behalf of officers and captains. But the yacht team specifically deals with all the employment related issues. So that's what I would do with my colleagues.
Sure. And is there a difference? Is Nautilus the only union that is supporting yacht crew at the time?
Yes.
Or is there another union out?
No.
Obviously there's tons of maritime unions.
There's maritime unions, but a lot of them don't tend to touch yachts. So you'll find internationally that there are, but they won't necessarily have the coverage for yachts because it's so niche. It's unlike any other maritime sector. You'll have organisations that provide advice and source advice and guidance and things, but they won't be able to provide the union assistance, so the representation and the legal services that Nautilus can do.
Right. So, yeah, something like we the are PYA, very much, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, the PYA do have like a welfare department and they can provide advice. They're not a union. So technically they're not a union. They won't be able to give you legal representation, for example, that you might ultimately end up needing that we can provide as part of our services.
Okay. Yeah. And you did kind of go over the services that you guys provide to Yacht Crew in times of need. Can we talk a little bit about the legal assistance and the counseling? How does it work? How do you get it? What's that process?
Yeah. Okay. So you've got to be a full member. I've got to stress this before anything. You can't, it's like an insurance company. You can't take out an insurance after you need to make a claim on it. So like you would insure your house, like you would insure your car, you need to insure your employment. So you take out a membership with us, which is an annual membership. And then if an employment dispute arises, you can contact us. So the legal assistance covers quite a few different elements. Okay. So we have legal assistance that covers maritime incidents. So if you're a captain or an officer and there is a maritime incident, such as a collision or a sinking, you can have access to the international network of lawyers for immediate advice and then representation. If you are found to have an inquiry and your certification is downgraded as a result of that, we can offer employment protection, so your salary is covered for that period. We can also provide legal advice and assistance on unpaid wage claims or general employment disputes. So if an element of your contract isn't being upheld, if you've not been paid your salary, first of all, it would come to myself and Cheryl in the ops department. We would try and resolve it amicably. But ultimately, if we can't do that, then it gets sent through to the legal department and they will seek to potentially appoint a lawyer internationally to handle the case on your behalf. And none of that would come a cost to the seafarer. It's all included as part of their membership fees. And then the other aspect
when you say it's all included,
yeah,
does that mean like, I mean, lawyers are expensive, right?
Lawyers are very expensive, and this is very important.
So I'm kind of wondering what is actually included. You say it's all included, and is there extra fees that we have to incur if we actually have to take legal action?
Yeah.
Do we get a credit with you guys? Like, how does that actually work?
So what happens is that if we can't resolve, and I will stress that the majority of times, I'm not blowing my own trumpet here, but a lot of the times we can actually resolve things quite amicably without the need of going down the legal route, because the legal route is a lengthy process. It's not straightforward. You don't just go out the next day and arrest a yacht and you get paid 3 days later. Legal battles can go on for years. So what we try and do for our members' interests is to resolve things as quickly as possible by arbitrating on their behalf, making these conversations, opening the dialogue, sending the letters, getting things resolved. But yes, if it's at that case where you can't do that and we need legal representation, then it goes to our legal department and they will assess the case. So I can't guarantee that every single case that lands on our table will be sent to a lawyer and a lawyer will be instructed. If you haven't been paid £300, say, for some invoices that haven't been settled, we wouldn't instruct a lawyer and the union wouldn't pay out £5,000 arresting the vessel to get you back £300. You know, all that money that is won in every court case goes straight to our member. We don't see any of it. But the union has got to be sensible in how we approach things. So our reserves that we have in our bank are spent on all the legal fees. We don't ask the member to contribute towards them. But we have to be mindful that our reserves are not there indefinitely. We've got to be careful with them. So we invest them in cases that are meritorious. So cases that are likely to succeed. And that's based on the assessment that the lawyers make on our behalf. If they say, yes, it's meritorious, and yes, this member is more likely to get the money, then we'll go ahead with it. But it's a case by case. Yeah.
And obviously this is in reference to something like payroll. What about legal counseling support when we're talking about sexual harassment, assault on board?
Okay, so if it's sexual harassment, I mean, that's a criminal offence. So we wouldn't be able to provide legal representation on that. We can provide employment related legal advice, but if someone was sexually assaulted, they would need to go down the criminal. They would need to report that to the authorities and then seek to have someone instructed on that behalf. We're not trained. Our lawyers aren't trained in that respect to provide that service. We would support the crew through making all the relevant reports and helping them with any employment related issue in relation to that. But when it comes to legal assistance, they'd need to go through criminal law for that.
Okay, so basically, the legal assistance that you guys offer is more in relation to payroll.
It's payroll, yeah. It's breaches of contract in general. Okay. So if you are fired,
so anything in relation to C agreement,
Yeah, anything to do with your fee agreement. So, for example, we deal with, well, like I say, a lot of the unpaid wage claims. That's the majority of the legal work we do in the yachts. We do have some discrimination cases where people have been terminated due to gender. We can seek representation on that. If you are injured at sea and it's an employment-related injury, we can provide personal injury support and legal services for that to get you recovery for compensation. So there's different elements. A lot of the legal services are on a case by case. It all depends on the specifics of what happened to the seafarer.
But we want to make it clear that if it's in relation to SASH, sexual assault or harassment, that's not something that's, you guys offer through the legal counseling.
It wouldn't necessarily fall through employment law. It would be criminal law. So we can't provide that service. But we can make recommendations and we can give referrals and signposting if they need that.
Okay, got it. So that's super important to know, because obviously a lot of people, the majority of women have always been harassing board, like no matter whether that be physically, verbally, but there's a lot more people talking openly when they do, and obviously wanting to go forward when they do get assaulted or physically harassed, whether that be sexually or violence or whatever that may be.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that we're talking about this, because then that I want to make it clear that if you are part of the union, that specific realm doesn't qualify you for legal advice through your legal team, basically.
Yeah.
That would be something you'd have to.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, bullying, harassment and assault and sexual assault, it is an issue at sea. It's something that the union is working with other organisations and groups to work on. It needs to be eliminated. But when it comes to actual legal representation, that we can't provide that, unfortunately. Yeah.
Is that something that you guys are down the road potentially
adding? It's not something that I could say. I'd have to speak to the legal department that, because it really depends on the area of expertise that it falls under. And when it comes to, say, sexual assault, if it was to happen in the UK, for example, usually the system in the UK is that you get given that representation. I mean, I don't know how it works internationally. Obviously, there's so many different jurisdictions. I just wouldn't be the one to comment on that. Yeah.
Yeah, everything just gets very gray. It's such a gray area because, let's say, I'm American on a Malta flag and that happened in France.
Yeah. Or it could happen in international waters. It's going to be difficult to find a jurisdiction that you can even take legal steps in. So it's a minefield.
Well, I really want to say that by speaking to lawyers myself, that if something happened at court, the jurisdiction is the port. So if they have a French port, that is their jurisdiction.
So our recommendation would be, if you have a sexual assault and you are at a port or you are in a certain jurisdiction, you report it there, but you could also report it to the flag of the vessel But you would expect the local authorities where the incident took place to actually handle the matter in the first instance. If you're at sea, so if you're in international waters, you would expect either the port of call where you're next going to, or contact the flag and ask for recommendations as to what would happen when you then next go into port. That would be the recommendation to take.
Okay. Thank you so much for that clarification, because I think that a lot of people see, they give legal advice, but we don't really get into the nitty gritty of what that actually means and how does that actually look like for us. Mm-hmm. Because I think, on June, you guys in Nautilus News reported that there was an increase of 125% rise in the violence at sea among seafarer abuse on yachts, discrimination, harassment, bullying, and all that. When it comes to discrimination, is that part of the legal counseling?
It can be. We have got a couple of cases at the minute where people have been discriminated due to gender. So that's being under review. And if it's a case that we think that we can take forward, then we will do on behalf of the seafarer. I mean, ultimately, if we can't take things forward and a seafarer still wanted to pursue a matter, they can certainly seek legal advice of their own independently. But what we don't want to do is put a seafarer in a position where they assign legal representation and it ends up costing them more than what they could potentially recover. So we try and be as honest with people as we possibly can about their case and whether they do have remit to take it further.
Okay.
Discrimination is something that I haven't really seen that often until very recently. I think we've got 3 cases currently that we're looking at. So it can happen, but maybe it does happen, but people just haven't been bringing it to our attention. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Well, I think it does happen a lot more. It's just that probably a lot of people don't come forward or don't talk about it, because, again, legal representation is quite expensive.
Yeah.
And I don't know, obviously, worldwide, but talking to French lawyers versus American lawyers, one of the differences is that in America, I can hire a lawyer, and when the case is settled, then they take their cut. But in French law, for example, that's not allowed to be done. So a lawyer, this lawyer said that they have to, as a minimum, they have to charge you one monthly salary, because that's kind of how they measure it. So obviously, some people have the money, especially if they're more on senior roles, but a younger 20-something on a very junior role, obviously, they're not going to have that amount of money. Yeah. So then they basically never come forward. People don't tend to come forward because of the lack of legal representation and the financial burden that could potentially do bring. So, or the lack of evidence sometimes, right? Because at the end of the day, especially with sexual harassment and assault, you do need evidence in order to go to the legal route. If not, it's kind of like he said, she said kind of thing. Yeah. One of the things that we see often in yachts that it kind of hasn't caught up to, let's say, the commercial side. But I feel like discrimination, that could be part of discrimination when all of a sudden you lose your job because you're pregnant or because you want to have an abortion. Can you give us a little bit of advice on how you guys handle that within the union and potentially what you guys are doing to support that?
Yeah, it's difficult because there isn't really a lot of scope even within commercial vessels. And it's not just yachts, it's in all maritime sectors for pregnancy in general. I think if you're on certain flags, you have more rights than others. So if you're a UK seafarer, you're going to have more rights than you are on another vessel, such as the Cayman Islands. I mean, basically, it will come down to what's in your contract. So a lot of maritime contracts are not going to have any protections for your career if you are found to be pregnant. And I think guidelines are you have to leave sea at a certain point for the unborn baby's sake. Now, usually what happens is that when you leave that, the employment will be terminated. Occasionally we find that people will be kept on, but they won't be given any maternity pay. It'll usually be unpaid. And then they can return after a certain amount of time when they're ready to full-time employment if they wish to. Some don't really want to go back after that. But when it comes down to, I think I've only ever seen two or three contracts that actually have in the handbooks that there's provisions there for maternity leave. It's just not very common. And the problem that we have with it, Marianne, is that it would come down to not just the flag state of the vessel, but I think it comes down more to the flag state of the labour supplier, so your home nation, as to what your rights are when you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. So if a UK seafarer was pregnant, she could come back to the UK and she could apply for maternity from the state. If you're not from the UK, but you're South African, you'd need to contact your labour supply, you need to contact the Social Security Department there to see what your rights are. But it's unlikely that under the Maritime Authority of where you come from, that there's going to be provisions for you. It's just, you just don't see it very often. But it's case by case. So if a member contacts us and they're on a Cayman Island vessel that's trading in French waters and they're South African, then we'll endeavour to look through every single jurisdiction to see if there are any provisions as well as in the contract. Because what you've got to remember is in your employment, you've got your employment terms and conditions. Sometimes that's extended into the handbooks if that's part of the contract. And then you've got your home nation and the flag. So there could be quite a lot of jurisdictions at play that might have some coverage for you, not just in relation to pregnancy, but anything and everything.
Yeah, I think that's why education is such an important part of all of this. Understanding your rights from, like you said, your home country, how does that translate to the seafarers? Yeah. Obviously, the flag state that you're choosing to work under or the boats register on. And then obviously where you're going to be mainly, you know, because usually we travel, but usually there's a base and that's where you usually tend to happen. I do agree that, and this is what I constantly tell women, you need to ask for a clause in regards of your woman health. If they don't want to give it to you, I think that's a massive red flag. So
I mean ultimately
your choice if you want to continue to work for somebody that doesn't care to give you those rights
or exactly the thing what people need to remember is
asking for it.
Well, if you don't ask, you don't get. And ultimately, a contract of employment, people think that they are just handed this contract and that you have to sign it. No, it's a negotiation. And the whole point is that it has to be your preferences as well as theirs. It's got to protect both of you. So like everything, people tend to just sign contracts, not just employment contracts, any contract, without actually reading through it and realizing what they're signing away. A lot of people, even nowadays, come to us and they go, my employer's just terminated me, this is unfair. And I'm like, but you signed an agreement that lets them terminate you. You put your name to that. And until enough people ask for that to be removed and realize that it's there in the first place, it's never going to go anywhere, because it's get out of jail card for the employer. So you get rid of anyone they want for no reason. So yes, negotiate. If you're not happy with the salary, negotiate. If you want extra terms put in there, there's usually on contracts, like on the first couple of pages, like a special editions, specials edit bit where you can add in extra things. So ask. And if you don't get it, like you say, do you want to work for an employer that has such little respect for you, that isn't going to treat you as you would want to be treated?
Exactly.
Yeah, this is the only way that we can make change, is by asking for it and demanding for it. And if enough people do it, you have the employers just have no choice than to accept it. Otherwise, they lose an entire workforce, don't they?
Exactly. And two things, ITF, in my own educational rabbit hole that I have been going through for years now, what I found is that certain flags like Malta, Bahamas, Panama, that are often in yachts, they actually sign a agreement with ITF in relation to pregnancy. And a lot of people don't know about this, but you can actually, if you're going into a Panamanian register vessel, you, in your sea agreement, you can say, hey, you guys signed an agreement with ITF about pregnancy clause, and then I want that to be added to my sea agreement. So I think education is so important, because there are certain flags that do care. Yes, maybe the bare minimum, but there's certain things there. And what they sign was that you need to get at least 2 months of salary after you become pregnant and you leave. And obviously that they cannot fire you for it.
Because
that would be obviously discrimination.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one that actually I might do a bit more research on it. Because if we can get something, the whole point is about power is knowledge. And if we can find something that is of use to anyone, then we'll do our best to endeavour to get it out on all our socials. So if you want to send me some links to this afterwards, then please do, because it's something that we're very keen to highlight to crew, definitely. So yeah, we can definitely pick up on that afterwards if you've got something you can share.
I will.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, you know how you said that we have to, if you're a member, you have to be a member before an issue arrives in order to ask for the help and the support. Is there like a time frame for certain things? Like,
so,
like, because you did make the reference similarity to a medical health insurance, where it's like, hey, if you didn't get the insurance before, you're not going to get support after.
Yeah.
So if I become a member today and I get a job tomorrow, or maybe I got the job today and I became a member today, can I send my C agreement and say, hey, I'm a woman, can you read this? How can I make sure that I'm covered?
Yeah. So when it comes to pre-existing issues, what we say is that if you suspect there's going to be a problem with something, so say you've just joined a vessel and you've heard that everyone else hasn't been paid last month, that's what we would say a pre-existing issue. But if you join a vessel and you've been paid January, February, March, and you join on the 31st of March, but then in April, you don't get paid as April, that's not a pre-existing issue. So you'd be entitled to the full support. So it's pretty straightforward. People do get a bit confused. You don't have to join us before you get a job. You can get a job, be working there for a few months and then join us. Or you can join us, as long as when you join us, you're not going to then the next day say, I need you to help me recover 3 months unpaid salary. You can join us and then send us your contracts and go, I'm a bit concerned about this clause and what it might mean, or what does this wording mean? Or do you think we can get something inserted in? Then that's absolutely fine. We can give that advice. We can look at that for you. That's not a problem. Yeah.
Perfect. And then, I had another question, but my brain. So we'll get back to that one. And then how does the union engage with Flag State's management company and yacht owners to promote fair labor practices? How do you guys manage, how yachts work?
Okay, well, so you've got like two examples there, haven't you? You've got the yachts where the big yachts. So let's just say the commercial size ones or the ones that will have management companies and DBA companies. So usually they will have more, they'll be a bit more regulated on board. They'll have policies and practices. So if you've got a dispute, you can go through the onboard complaints policy. And then if it's not resolved, you can go through the shoreside complaints policy. And if it's not resolved, then you take it to the flag. And if it's still not resolved, then you can report it higher. So there's a number of ways on a commercial size vessel that you can take things. And we can support people all the way through that, talking them through each step and being their representative through all of that. When you're talking about these smaller, maybe pleasure yachts, they're unlikely to have that process behind them, and there would be less statutory regulations on them. But that's not to say that you don't have rights. If you've got a contract of employment, then you've got contractual law. And even without a contract of employment, sometimes there's statutory laws there. So, for example, the Cayman Islands this year released their new legislation, which made it illegal on a Cayman Island vessel not to have a contract. So there's some level there for everybody. And even on like a private vessel, you should have the right to repatriation if it's not written in your contract. So we can take things further. Even if the captain is a one-man band, you know, what they've got there is what's called the asset, which is the yacht. So if things aren't being done properly, a seafarer has the right to have a maritime lien against the vessel. And that's how usually you recover your losses against the employer or the vessel owner. So it's really hard to try and give you examples because every single one is a little bit different. But all I would say is that there's, even on a private vessel, there's things that you can do to represent crew.
But as a union, do you guys reach out to flag states? Do you guys reach out to management companies to kind of make sure that potentially they are practicing what they preach sometimes?
Yeah. So the maritime, you know, about the Maritime Labour Convention is like the minimum labour standards for crew internationally. And it's applied on commercial vessels, but it should be applied by all vessels, really. You shouldn't really fall below that. Well, our legal director sits on the tripartite agreement, committee that actually forms the Maritime Labour Convention. So he is actually a voice for the seafarers. So seafarers will speak to us. They will let us know what they want changing. This is then relayed at these committees. And that's how the Maritime Labour Convention changes. And that's how it's implemented. So flag states, yacht owners, the representatives, the employers' representatives, there's people from every table at these events. And so ultimately, the Maritime Labour changes.
I do have a question about that. You have the MLC, obviously MLC only works or not works, but it's if your country is part of the MLC convention, like for example, US is not part of the MLC, so nothing MLC relates to US. Mm-hmm. But when it comes, but the majority of flags that are being registered on yachts, the majority are MLC. And
they are.
Then we have the ones that we usually tend to call toy flags, because they really, even though they are MLC, they don't, it's kind of weird because for me, it's like, who inside the MLC allows this to happen and how does it actually work?
So you've got the flags that are ratified MLC. Mm-hmm. So say you mentioned America earlier. No, America hasn't ratified the MLC, but if an American flagged vessel came to international waters and entered the waters of a country that has ratified the MLC, and if that vessel was chartering, so if that vessel had actually been, say, flagged to Malta and it entered Malta's waters because it had been chartering, it would have to abide by the MLC. It would have to apply the rules of the waters that it was in. When you've got private
but
vessels,
not on your sea agreement.
So, no, they wouldn't have to do it on your sea, but if your sea doesn't meet the criteria of the MLC and the MLC applies, then it overrides it anyway. So say the MLC minimum is 7 days notice, for example, and 30 days annual leave. If you're an American flag vessel and you've been given a contract that doesn't give you any annual leave and they can just know to terminate you within 24 hours, if that vessel travels into the waters of Malta and you get terminated, you would be entitled to your 7 days notice. If this vessel was commercial and it enters into the waters of Malta, you'd be given 7 days notice and you would be given annual leave, accrued annual leave, because the MLC states that this applies because your vessel is now in our water. So what you need to do is obviously stand up for your rights, contact the union for that representation in order to make sure that your final salary is everything that you should be entitled to. Now, when you've got pleasure vessels, whether they be flags to America or Malta, because they're not chartering, because they're below a certain weight, they're not going to fall under the MLC. So what you need to do is make sure that your contract provides you as much coverage as possible, because that's your protection.
But my question is, for this, for the people that are advocating, right, the union, you guys, mm-hmm. like, this is obviously a loophole, this whole pleasure boat bullshit. That's what it is. Because at the end of the day, yes, I might be working on a pleasure boat. So then a lot of all these laws and policies and regulation doesn't apply to me as a worker. But at the end of the day, I am working. It's a job, yeah. right? This is a business. I have an employer. I'm the employee. So why on earth does it all of a sudden everything changes because the boat is not charter, aka commercial, but it's still a business. You are employing people, right? Like,
yeah, you're employing people.
I'm not
people,
there
yeah.
for free. I'm not volunteering.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I would rather see every single private contract mirror, at the very minimum, the MLC, because the MLC is not the gold standard. It's the entry level.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's entry
like
level.
Basic,
it's like the basic bare minimum. Exactly. If you're a private vessel and you're not even offering the basics, then why would anyone want to work with you for the first instance? I'd rather see crew members. And this is obviously, so it's going to take time to see, but I would rather see crew members just refuse to work on any vessel, private or pleasure or commercial.
How can we do that? How can we advocate?
I think it has to start at home on some levels. I think the crew members need to start saying, I'm not prepared to work in an environment that isn't offering international minimum standards. So if you refuse to work for a company that isn't offering that and enough people refuse to do it, then ultimately these employers and vessels have no choice then but to increase. It's a market, isn't it? If you're not getting the decent crew working for you, then you can't do what you want to do on your yacht. So ultimately, it starts at home in the first place. It starts with self-empowerment. You have to say, until things change on a bigger scale and these people are forced to change terms and conditions, I'm going to refuse to work for you. And so are my fellow seafarers. It has to start with yourselves at some point as well. It's difficult.
But why isn't Flag State making that change?
It's only an answer that the Flag States can give you. I mean, I pointed earlier on to Cayman Islands, who are quite a big flag, like a lot of vessels are flagged to them.
Yeah.
They, earlier this year, changed their legislation. So at least now, employees working on a pleasure vessel have to have a contract of employment. You know, that has to be given to them. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are entitled to certain terms and conditions like minimum holidays, but at least if they've been given that contract, it's a starting point. And this is what we need to see is other flag states following their lead. And that would be amazing. All we can do is advocate for it, you know. We keep on requesting it, keep on demanding it, because that's the route
that
we want to see.
So from our side as crew members, we obviously need to start requesting what's the bare minimum.
Yeah, I mean, listen, get yourself a copy of the MLC. It's on our website. Download it. Understand what the bare minimum is. And also compare that to what you expect, which is probably going to be better than the bare minimum, and tell people that's what you're prepared to work for. If they want to have your services on board, then they should respect you, because these people are where they are because they've earned lots of money. It's not like they can't afford to provide you with a decent employment contract.
Okay, so we can do that as crew members. Is Nautilus actively advocating for this at some level?
We are with the MLC, so obviously if we can get it into the MLC, then it becomes legislation in all the ratified countries. So all we can say is, listen, we have to act on what we're told. So when you're part of the union, it's a demographic. It's like, you come to us, you tell us what you need. We then take that to the next level. So we can only progress things if we understand what the seafarer needs, what are the challenges, what are the things that need revising. If you let us know, we then are the voice of the seafarer. We'll take that as far as we absolutely can to lobby it, to speak at the ILO, to get it changed, to get it implemented, and then you start to benefit from the outcomes of it. So join the union, get yourself registered in all our forums. We've got women's forums, we've got LGBT+, we've got equity and diversity, professional and technical department. There's loads of forums that you can enter. Tell us what you want. Tell us what you need. And this is the start of the process. It lets us do something with it. Yeah,
absolutely. I agree. And then one of the things that is just mind-blowing is that on super yachts, there's no background checks. And it's absolutely ridiculous because, like, for example, if I work for the same owner of a super yacht, but I'm actually going to work for their state or their villa, because this has happened to me personally. Okay. When I work on the super yacht, I didn't get a background check. When I went to work on his state, I got a massive background check from my finances to like my criminal records and everything, because that's what the land-based job require. Mm-hmm. So for me, I mean, I don't understand how these owners and even captains, they don't care enough to know who's actually coming into the vessel, and they don't vet them properly. And my question is, at a union level, at a policy level, is that a policy in commercial vessels?
I think that's just very much comes down to the company themselves, the employee themselves, as to whether or not they do that. There's no regulatory requirement of it, because you shouldn't be discriminated against for having a criminal background, for example, unless that was in relation to something. So say, for example, childcare, for example. There's certain careers and certain roles where if you had a criminal background, you would be prohibited from doing it. But I can't advocate that someone shouldn't get a job because they have a criminal background, because that would be discriminative. But I know where you're probably leading this question. Are you talking about like backgrounds on sexual assault, for example, and then working on a vessel where you're going to be in close quarters at sea with...
Yeah, because to work and then go home and there's a break and everybody follows a corporate
It's interesting. I know that there was a group meeting and Nautilus was represented there. The ILO and the IMO were talking about bullying and harassment at sea, for example. This was earlier this year. And there was discussions about how to cut out bullying, harassment and sexual assault. And one of the things they spoke about was actually removing certification for anybody that was found guilty of sexual assault. If you remove their certification, you remove their ability to go to sea.
Exactly.
So if you are convicted, not just accused, but convicted of sexual assault, then that would be a remit to then remove them from the industry.
Thankfully, former crew members I don't want to say his name wrong, I believe Connor, if I'm not mistaken, he created Crew Pass, which is a background check verification for yacht crew members. And a lot of people are like, well, iron references enough. I'm like, not really, because one, they can lie. Two, and this happens more often that we want to admit. Two, it could be your friend, you know what I mean? It could be somebody that really liked you, and not really somebody, because we tend to just put the ones that we know are going to give us a good reference, right?
Yeah.
And like you said, we live in such a close quarters. Like, wouldn't you want to know if that person has been convicted or if that person has been arrested for certain things?
So Crew Pass, will they do criminal background checks then?
They do.
They do. And they do employers use Crew Pass quite regularly?
Now they are, because management companies are being supporting the cost. So now a lot of the management companies that are recruiting for owners or for yachts are asking them. That's like a standard. So I certainly do when I support certain vessels and captains that I know or owners that I know with like the recruitment process, they have to go through Crew Pass. And if you don't want to go through Crew Pass, you're not going to be eligible for the job, because that right there immediately tells me you're hiding something.
That's really interesting, actually.
So we have to, like you said, the same way we have to stand up and ask for our sea agreement to be a better quality, we also have to stand up and say, hey, who is going to be sleeping under me or on top of me or to me?
Yeah, exactly. You know? And who are you going to be left alone with? Because the employer has a duty of care towards their employees.
Because that's safety, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you have to get certificates to prove vessel safety. So you should get certificates to prove crew safety, shouldn't you? Yeah.
It's like we worry more about the trash, which, don't get me wrong, is important. Environment is important. But then we totally lose it when it comes to safety on board in regards of humans, which is like, is the ones that run the machine. If you don't have the crew, the yacht doesn't exist, period. I was just kind of wondering how the union is kind of maneuvering that conversation. Or if it's even a conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it should be a conversation. And obviously, I'm interested to learn more about Crew Pass and how they go about it. Because, as I say, we have to be careful we don't discriminate against people because of their history. But at the same time, yes, there is a level of care and a duty of care for people who are working at sea in environments where they're alone. So it's something that
a lot of people keep, you know, 20 years in the industry, and I keep seeing the same perpetrators continuing to get a job. How is that even possible?
It's worrying,
isn't
it?
Why are they not losing their license?
This is the thing. I mean, if the thing I was talking about earlier between the ILO and the IMO is someone is convicted, that would ultimately result in that outcome. So that would but that's about them getting convicted, this being reported. Yeah. So,
but I think that's the key, because a lot of the time people don't talk because their mentality is, well, nothing will happen.
The problem is that even land-based assaults, sexual assaults, I mean, I don't know what proportion get reported, and I don't know of that what proportion actually get convicted. I don't imagine it's particularly high because it's quite a difficult area. It's not just at sea. We're talking about an issue that's across the whole globe, isn't it? In every single type of employment, there's that risk, and that can happen. It is difficult. I wish I had the answers, but all we can say is if there's something that we can do, we can seek to do it. People just need to speak out to us and let us know that it's happening. We can have those conversations.
And for example, with the bullying, harassment, and even sexual harassment and all that, I see often in different, not in the maritime sector, but even in the maritime sector, let's say cruise ships, for example, obviously it's very corporate oriented, right? Like you're working for a corporation and there's a lot of laws involved, and there's a lot of, it's not perfect, but it's definitely a lot better than what we get on yachts. Yeah. For example, every year, every crew member on board has to go through a training on what sexual harassment is, what bullying is, what discrimination is, what it could potentially look like on board. So there's like this continuous education training on the forefront, yet on pleasure boats, even if they're charters, they're still pleasure boats because they're yachts in their mind, right? They're not commercial. There's that lack of training. There's that lack of policy and regulation around how do we really, education is key to keep people safe, right?
Yeah, it is. I think you need to use an instrument then that isn't just applicable to commercial vessels. So, I mean, the MLC makes it very clear that bullying, harassment and assault is zero tolerance. And the ISM code could be utilized as a tool for that. But the SCCW is something that's going to apply to every single seafarer, no matter what vessel that you're on. So this is a tool where you can implement changes, whether that be the requirement of extra training, awareness. And that was actually one of the other ideas that was raised during the ILO-IMO Tripartite Working Group agreement meeting early this year, where they were talking about how they can roll this out to make it as across the board as possible.
Exactly.
And the SCCW was raised as a possibility of,
I think, using that's a great possibility because everybody needs SCCW. Well, and we're going to talk about this, but majority of people need SCCW to work on board. Mm-hmm. If you by law have to take your SCCW every 5 years, why are we not also adding that every year you have to retake your bullying, harassment, whatever course in order to continue to work on board?
Yeah.
And that's not something that the owner has to do, but something that you as a seafarer have to do, whether you're working or not, if you want to continue to be and it's eligible,
It's such a simple thing to do to implement that as well. It would be so simple to have that included.
Exactly. And when it comes to SCCW, I'm finding out, which I didn't even know this, but apparently not every vessel requires you to have SCCW, which I thought it was like the bare minimum for any seafarer.
If that's the case, obviously I would encourage them to get it even if they're not being asked to. But I would also, I'd also like to know like what the flag of the vessel is and the type of the vessel that they're on, just to make some informal inquiries on their behalf, just to see if this is actually, should this be in place or not? Because if it isn't in place, then why isn't this a standard? Yeah, I'd like to know a little bit more if you could find out some more information about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I will. Okay. I do have some information, so I definitely will give you some of that. And give me a successful story of how Nautilus significantly impacted a yacht crew member's life.
Yeah. Okay. So we can talk about like the monetary side of things. So you may have seen in the news this year, Alfa Nero was arrested by Nautilus and we've had a successful case, which is ongoing, but we've won a successful element of it so far. So when it comes to the thing that we deal with most, which is unpaid wages, I think this year we're already, need to finalise the figures, but we're already well over €1 million euros in recovering unpaid salaries. I think since 2020, when we started keeping these records, it's over 5.7 million. And I think if we include last year, it'll be getting towards 7 million. We'll wait to report that. So that's how we monitor the majority of the work that we do. Success stories for everybody else. It's the little things. So it's the getting people home when they've been abandoned shoreside. It's following them through from grievances and disciplinaries all the way through the process till they get their outcome, whether that be that they get reinstated or whether or not they'd be sent home. It's about giving them that support there. I can't give you specific examples because I'm prohibited from talking too much about certain cases due to non-disclosure agreements, but we'd like to do I don't know, maybe we could do an end of year summary report or something, where we can talk about people who are willing to give us consent to talk about their cases, because that would be quite nice, I think. But yeah, the majority that we do, I mean, is always going to be the salaries, because that's the thing that we see most in this sector is the unpaid wages. And the way we can document that is just by saying how much money we've recovered for them during that period. Yeah. And okay, it's quite significant. And the thing is that these seafarers wouldn't have had this unless they spent a lot of money on legal fees themselves trying to get it back. So that's the key. That's the key.
So let's talk about certain things that should be improving the union from the research that I did talking to members that have been part of the union or that are currently in the union. And what I saw was like, there were three things that just kept. So one of the things was the 24/7 helpline response delays, in the sense of members have reported not receiving immediate responses or adequate support when reaching out to the helpline, which undermines trust in the service. Also, they said, you know, that jackcrew often require urgent assistance on weekends and after hours due to the job being obviously a 24/7 job. Mm-hmm. And then for what I saw often, it was like, well, I had this issue. I called the 24/7 helpline, but at the end of the day, they couldn't support me because I had to wait until Monday for the actual support to arrive. But then Monday is too late for them because by Friday evening, they were already kicked out of the vessel.
Okay.
So that's one of the things. And then the other thing was payment and the challenges with the memberships. Mm-hmm. A lot of them said that payments issues were not processed automatically, which led them to unknowingly losing their union rights. And then I talked to some of them and asked them like a little bit more, and they say, we're in the middle of the season. I didn't see the email on time. When I did actually end up, paying again, then they did. It was like, now you're again a new member, not versus like, oh, you've been a member with us for 1-2 years. Other people said that even after attempting to reinstate the membership, the payments continue to fail. And then for them, it's almost like, well, life catches up. And that's obviously not their priority, especially because they are not having an issue at the moment. So they don't make it a priority. So yeah, so that those two things. And then obviously, I think that you talked about the third one very importantly at the beginning, which it was the lack of clarity on eligibility for assistance, because a lot of people, they have been told, well, you are not a member, so we cannot give you support. So immediately they become a member to get the support. But then they're told, well, but this was prior to you becoming a member, so you still won't get the support that you sign up for. So those are the three things that I continue to hear over and over from previous and current members. Okay. What are your thoughts on that?
It's interesting, actually. I'm glad you raised them, because obviously if there's any feedback, we need to know this in order for us to address it. The union is an office here. We are 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. So in those hours, UK time, please contact us directly. You don't need to go through the 24/7 helpline. It'll just slow the process down. Just phone the office directly or email yachts directly. We pick it up from there. That's the quickest way to get the ball rolling. In out of office hours, so in the evenings and weekends, what you'd need to do is either still contact yachts department directly and we'll pick it up on the Monday morning, or you can contact the 24/7 helpline. Now, the 24/7 helpline isn't there just for the general query. So if you've not been paid November's salary and it's the 10th of the following month, they're not going to do any immediate work on that, because that's something that needs to be looked into. We need to then. But if you're being thrown off a vessel, I mean, you made a comment about one of the people that had raised concerns about that she needed assistance before the Monday morning. So I'm going to assume that it was some kind of repatriation problem. You can still phone 24/7 helpline, and you need to make it very clear when you're speaking to them, because they are advisors and they are capable of taking things and escalating things further. If you need to make it clear to them that you're being abandoned or that you've been threatened, for example, and you need to speak to an officer straight away, they will put you through to somebody. So even in out of hours, you can be put through to someone in the union here to speak to whatever time of day that be. Okay. So you just need to make it very clear that when you're on the phone to them, that this isn't something that can wait till Monday.
Yeah, the priority of the issue, yes.
Yeah,
because a lot of people tend to not say what's really happening.
Yeah,
just give you the headline. It's like, hey, the headline is not really the issue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We need to establish what is just basically reporting a problem that myself and my team can look into the following Monday, or reporting an issue that within the next 24 hours, I think, so say, let me give you this as an example. So say you have been terminated and they're asking you to leave the vessel, okay? And they're going to repatriate you. So they're not leaving you shoreside, they're going to repatriate you. And they're giving you a document to sign that says, this is my final salary, but you don't think that figure's correct, okay? This 24/7 helpline will send us through that information. And they will tell the seafarer, just don't sign the document because you're under no obligation to sign that document. You've got a contract of employment. So at the end of the month, they'll have to pay you anyway, even if you sign this termination agreement or not. So again, don't refuse to leave until you've been paid. You can get home, you can be repatriated. And on Monday, the yacht department will look into everything. They'll work with you to get the termination agreement revised so that it's correct before you sign it. And then at the end of that month, you'll be paid. That is an example of something that can be reported to 24/7, but wait till Monday for us to do. If on Saturday you're being thrown off a vessel and they intend to leave port and there's no port authority there, there's no one there to sort of assist you to speak to the captain in order to get them to book your flights, and you phone 24/7, they will then put you through to somebody at the union here to speak to in order to give you advice on what you need to do, because that would be, we wouldn't have someone left on a shoreside, on a dockside.
For example, something like, because if it's sexually harassment or sexual assault, mm-hmm. do we not contact the 24/7 helpline?
You can report it to the 24/7 helpline, but you really need to report it to the flag state as well, and you need to report it to local authorities. So there's as many authorities as possible. The 24/7 helpline, they won't be able to get in touch with the flag state for you because the flag state is unlikely going to be manning their phones. But there will be an emergency number. If you contact the flag state on their website, there'll be an emergency number out of our support. Yeah. They can give you advice. And obviously the local authorities, the police authorities where you are, mm-hmm. they're going to be there 24/7 as well.
Like, I'm going to give you a small example just so you tell me if that's something we can inquire in the support helpline.
Yeah.
Because I get weekly calls from crew members. Mm-hmm. So this girl, she was being harassed by two of the crew members on board. Captain wasn't on board, and she wanted to leave. She wanted to get out. Mm-hmm. She didn't have her passport, because usually they take your passport away when you get on board. And they were threatening her to not contact the captain. They basically mm-hmm. had her mind games. And she was like, I want to leave, but I don't have my passport. They don't want to give me my passport. And they threatened me about me contacting the captain. Who do we call in that scenario?
So again, it would be the port authorities if you're in a port, because they should be able to intervene. If you're being refused to leave the vessel because they've got your passport, again, it would be the local authorities, because you can't be kept held captive. You can phone the 24/7 helpline. They'll be able to refer it to us for the Monday and potentially put you through to one of the organisers here for advice on the steps you take and who you need to contact. And if you're there, so it was breaking up a little bit. You were saying, who was it who was actually recording, who was withholding? Was it the captain or was it somebody else?
No, so the captain wasn't on board. And then okay. the crew member was being harassed by two of the other crew members, the engineer and the mate. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to leave the vessel, but they were not, they wouldn't give her passport. And they mm-hmm. were threatening her about contacting the captain. So obviously this is somebody that doesn't have boundaries, so, somebody that's yeah. obviously traumatized, somebody that
yeah.
cannot stand up for herself at the moment.
Okay. Well, what I would have expected the 24/7 helpline to have done is to tell the person, if they didn't feel safe on board, to get off the vessel, even without their passport, find themselves somewhere safe to go to, and then we'll take the case from there. If that wasn't the advice that was given to the seafarer, all I can say is that if she can contact us directly and let us know what was said and what advice was given, or that would be quite interesting.
But ideally, the 24/7 helpline, even if they cannot support you, quote unquote, immediately, because obviously we need the services from you guys when you're at the office, mm-hmm. they should be able to give you some sort of guidance on,
yeah.
hey, these are the steps you need to take immediately. And this yes. is how we are going to potentially support you as soon yes. as we can, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the 24/7 helpline should be able to give you that advice. They are trained regularly by our director of legal services.
Or call the police, get on yes. the boat, whatever it is.
Yes.
That,
you know, absolutely. The, yeah. Okay, all those great. Steps. Yes. Okay, yeah. Perfect. 100%. Yeah.
Because a lot of the times what I see is that what people need is just guidance. Is that
yeah, because your head is all over the place. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just need someone to tell you very calmly the process that you need to
exactly.
go through.
So
that
step you can one, step it. Two, step three.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
great. And then last question to you is, can you explain the process on how a seafarer yacht crew can become a member union?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really easy process. So if you go to our website, which is www.nautilus.com, nautilusint.org. So it's nautilusint.org. And then you go to the Join Us page. You scroll down to the yacht section and you can pick crew or officers, depending if you're a crew or an officer. And then you go through, you fill in all your details, and that gets submitted to us. If you're being referred to us by yourselves, then you get a discount on your first year's membership fee. So all you need to do then is email us. So you can email membership@nautilusint.org and just tell us that you've been referred from yourselves. And then we'll, in the back office, apply the discount and we'll issue you a payment link. Just before, you were talking about a problem with people making payments. So the system changed this year. It was beyond our control. But basically, because people pay internationally, in the UK, you can set up a direct debit, but internationally, you need to make a payment online. Now, you can either do that in one lump sum, and it's all done and dusted, or you can do it as like a regular payment. But sometimes when people set up their payments, they're doing it in a way that requires us by law to email them a link that then they click to authorize the payment. So we can't collect membership fees until they do that. And we do send them an email letting them know exactly what they need to do step by step. Until they click that link, we can't collect membership fees. So it's really important that they do that, and then that's set up so that we can collect fees going on, whether they pay monthly or quarterly.
But is
or
there
annually.
Something that can be automatic of like...
We're working on it. Yes, we're working on it.
So it's not yet established, but at
it's,
some point...
No, it's going to be... we're hoping early next year, we can change or give more options for payments. So that issue shouldn't be a problem going forward. Yeah.
For example, sometimes we lose our card or whatever, if the card changed, and obviously... Well, it's not yet automatic, right? So that couldn't be an issue, right?
So
you tried to charge and then the card didn't go through. That couldn't be an issue because it's not automatic.
No, so it will be. So say you pay monthly. So you need to authorize the first month, and then we could automatically collect it every month. If you lost your card or your card was cancelled, we wouldn't be able to collect it then because it'd be linked to the card rather than your bank account. So what we would do is we would email you and tell you, look, there's a problem. We always send out email reminders on a monthly basis to say this is happening. Do you still want your membership? You need to let us know what your new card details are. And that would be the case if anybody's card had expired or if the amount of money that they pay changes. So if, for example, you are a deckhand and then you phone us up to say, look, I've got my certificates now, I'm an officer, the amount that you pay per month would change slightly because it would include the ticket protection because you're now an officer and you've got tickets. You would then need to authorise a new payment because the figures have changed. So the law says that we need to ask you to say, I'm prepared to increase how much we collect from your bank. Okay. So those would be the scenarios when that would happen. But as I say, the membership team are working on different offers and different ways of collecting fees without this constant need to have you authorise the payments.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a perfect world. Obviously, you guys are working on it, which is great to hear. But I do think that us as crew members, like, everything's great until it isn't. And when it isn't, it's just really bad usually. Make it a priority to make sure that payment goes through. If you have issues, just contact directly and just get it over. It's
get
not
it
that difficult. It's just an email. 24/7 helpline.
Click that link and just make sure you set up your reminders. Happen. Yeah. If you sign up for a full year, and you know you're going to lapse after a year, I mean, we'll send you a reminder, but just put it in your diary and say, I need to renew my membership, because if you accidentally let it lapse and then you need us, unfortunately, it is going to be a pre-existing issue then. And that's not what we want for anybody. We don't want to have that conversation. It's not pleasant for us that we can't help people. I mean, even if it's a pre-existing issue, what I would say is that we do still give verbal advice. So we'll have a conversation on the phone with anybody that joins with a pre-existing issue. But unfortunately, what we won't be able to do is give them that representation or legal representation that they may end up ultimately needing. So I'd like to avoid that. And I'd like to make sure that everyone is in the best place possible for giving the full support that they need from the union.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Lara. This has been
amazing.
A lot of things we have talked about. I hope that this really gave a lot of knowledge and clarity to the yacht crew members of why becoming part of the union, Nautilus specifically, which is the one that is supporting us these days, is so important. And not really important, it's essential. If we really just want to have that support that we need, because we are outside of country, with people, random people that we don't know in very crazy environments.
There's no other career like it, honestly. There is no other career like it. And you just need to know that there is somebody there to have these conversations
with. There's somebody there that will make the difference. That definitely does make a difference. And I'm glad that it's more on the forefront, because like I said, I didn't even know about you guys until 5 years ago, which basically is at the end of my career. Yeah. I was like, damn it. I wish I knew about this before. I had so many headaches.
I know. We need to get out there more, don't we?
Yes, yeah. For sure. But this is part of it. We're definitely making it happen right now. So if there's anything else you would like to say before we wrap up?
I would just say, look, it's really important. It's not an awful lot of money. It's the equivalent of having a coffee every week. And for the protections that you get out of it compared to either losing the money entirely or not having someone to turn to, it's just worth every penny. So please give it serious consideration. And when you are in membership, make sure that you stay there, because we're here to support you. That's the whole point of us. And the union is made up of its members. So we're all here in one big team. So let's see what we can do.
Exactly. And I am a partner of Natalos. So if you are not a member yet, you can definitely get a discount on your first year. So like Laura says, sign up, email membership at
NautilusInt.org.
Yeah. And all the details are below the video. So there's no excuses, and get your discount. And just stay safe out there and have the support that you need whenever you need it. So thank you, Laura, again for this conversation. And obviously for the union and all the people that are advocating for our rights and just making it better. One baby step at a time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, guys. Until next time.